This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery.
Welcome, I'm Natalie Pynchon, and this is the July 25th, 2014 podcast, which includes articles on the following topics: functional neurosurgery, traumatic brain injury, oncology, stereotactic radiosurgery, hydrocephalus, and infection. Correlation of diffusion tensor tractography and intraoperative macrostimulation during deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease. A clinical article by Nicholas Said and colleagues. The purpose of this study was to investigate whether diffusion tensor imaging, or DTI, of the corticospinal tract is a reliable surrogate for intraoperative macrostimulation through the deep brain stimulation, or DBS, leads. The authors hypothesized that the distance on MRI from the DBS lead to the corticospinal tract, as determined by DTI, would correlate with intraoperative motor thresholds from macrostimulations through the same DBS lead. They retrospectively reviewed pre- and postoperative MRI studies and intraoperative macrostimulation recordings in 17 patients with Parkinson's disease who were treated using DBS stimulation. Preoperative DTI tractography of the corticospinal tract was co-registered with postoperative MRI studies showing the position of the DBS leads. The shortest distance and the angle from each contact of each DBS lead to the corticospinal tract were automatically calculated. The analysis showed a non-significant trend for voltage thresholds to increase when the distances between the DBS leads and the corticospinal tract increased. There was a significant but weak correlation between the angle and the voltage. Thus, caution needs to be exercised when using DTI tractography information to guide DBS lead placement in patients with Parkinson's disease. Further studies are needed in which DTI tractography measurements are compared to other approaches such as microelectrode recordings and conventional intraoperative MRI-guided placement of DBS leads. Outpatient follow-up of non-operative cerebral contusion and traumatic subarachnoid hemorrhage. Does repeat head CT alter clinical decision-making? A clinical article by Sebastian Rubino and co-authors. Many neurosurgeons obtain repeat head computed tomography at the first clinic follow-up visit for non-operative cerebral contusions and traumatic subarachnoid hemorrhage. The authors of this study undertook a single-center retrospective study to determine whether outpatient head CT scans altered clinical decision-making for patients with these pathologies. The cohort consisted of 173 patients. At clinic follow-up, 60% of the patients were asymptomatic. 39% had mild, nonspecific neurological symptoms, and less than 1% had significant neurological symptoms. None of the patients underwent surgical intervention because of follow-up head CT findings. Only one asymptomatic patient underwent a change in medical management because of follow-up head CT findings. This study illustrates that repeat outpatient head CT scanning of asymptomatic patients after non-operative cerebral contusions and traumatic subarachnoid hemorrhage is very unlikely to demonstrate significant new pathology. Given the cost and radiation exposure associated with head CT scans, imaging should be reserved for patients with significant symptoms or focal findings on neurological examination. Stereotactic radiosurgery for brain metastases, a case-matched study comparing treatment results for patients 80 years of age or older versus patients 65 to 79 years of age. A clinical article by Shinya Watanabe and co-workers. Recently, an increasing number of patients with brain metastases, even patients over 80 years of age, have been treated with stereotactic radiosurgery. However, there is little information on the results of this treatment in patients 80 years of age or older. The aim of this study was to reappraise whether radiosurgical treatment results for patients in this age group differ from those of patients 65 to 79 years of age. Among 2,552 consecutive patients who underwent stereotactic radiosurgery for the treatment of brain metastases during the 1998 to 2011 period, the author studied 165 patients who were at least 80 years old and 1,181 patients who were 65 to 79. Because there was a remarkable disproportion in patient numbers and considerable bias in pre-radiosurgery clinical factors between the two groups, the authors conducted a case-matched study. Ultimately, 330 patients, 165 in each age group, were selected. Although the post-radiosurgery median survival time was shorter in the older group of patients, at 5.3 months, than in the 65 to 79-year-old group, at 6.9 months, this difference was not statistically significant. Furthermore, the 80 years and older group had non-inferior results as compared to the 65 to 79-year-old group, in terms of neurological death, local recurrence, repeat radiosurgery, maintenance of good neurological state, and radiosurgery-related complications. The results of this study suggest that carefully selected patients 80 years of age or older are not poor candidates for stereotactic radiosurgery as compared to those 65 to 79 years old. Patient outcomes and surgical complications in coccidioidomycosis-related hydrocephalus, an institutional review, a clinical article by Douglas Hardesty and colleagues. Coccidioidoid mycosis is a common fungal infection in the southwestern United States. Hydrocephalus is a serious complication of cranial coccidioidoid mycosis, and the surgical management of coccidioidoid mycosis-related hydrocephalus has unique challenges. The authors retrospectively identified 44 patients diagnosed with coccidioidomycosis-related hydrocephalus at the Barrow Neurological Institute since 1990, who underwent 99 shunting procedures. The majority of patients identified were young men whose median age was 37 years at diagnosis. The average follow-up after shunting was approximately 5 years. Patients of Asian and African descent were overrepresented in the cohort when compared to regional demographic data. The shunt failure rate during follow-up was high, at 50% of patients. The majority of shunt failures were due to mechanical blockages in the drainage system. Most patients had at least partial persistent ventricular megaly despite successful cerebrospinal fluid diversion. 4 patients, representing 9% of the cohort, died due to coccidioidomycosis during the follow-up period. The authors conclude that coccidioidomycosis-related hydrocephalus has a high rate of shunt failure, and that many patients will have persistent ventricular megaly despite adequate shunt function. The morbidity and mortality of this chronic disease process must be recognized by the treatment team, and patients must be appropriately counseled.
Thank you for listening. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org. And for more information on how to submit your research to the Journal of Neurosurgery, please visit thejns.org and click on Info for Authors.